This is a download from BFM 89.9, the business station.
Welcome to Health and Living with me, T. Xiaoyik. Arguably, parents and children face the biggest challenges in the second year of the pandemic, where we saw continued school closures, a spike in the number of children getting COVID-19, and the introduction of vaccination for teenagers, among others. How have children and parents been coping, and how did the pandemic control strategies, you know, things like lockdowns, restrictions on movement, affect all of them? In the third episode of this series, where we reflect on 2021, consultant pediatrician Dr. Raki Yadav and Dr. Melati Nungsari, a parent, are joining me to look at the year that was at home for both parents and children. How are the both of you today?
I'm good, Xiaoyik, comparatively to what's happening around the world, but I'm really good today.
In fact,
I'm good as well.
All three of us are parents. So this might turn out to be a therapy session, you know, something quite cathartic for us. I'm going to throw this one at the both of you straight away. What would be the one word that would sum up this year for you as a parent? Dr. Melati first, maybe.
This year has been, I think, very chaotic. It's been a year of balancing a lot of plates, you know, balancing my own career, balancing the kids, but the kids' education, the kids' health. So I think chaos was sort of the theme of 2021 for me. And I suspect a lot of parents.
And, you know, I want to explore that balancing a little bit more later on as well. What about you, Dr. Raki? You're a parent, but also as a pediatrician, as a clinician, seeing children.
My one word would be messy. It's a mess, you know, because there were so many things introduced in 2021, and it was so messy as a parent to know what to do, when to do. Do I go out with my kids? Is it one person per car? Is it three people per car? Do I take my kids to the mall? Oh, they're not allowed to go. Do I take them to the cinema? Oh, below 17, not allowed. You know, so it was very messy because there were so many things going on with no clear guidelines.
All right. Messy and chaotic, you know, go hand in hand, definitely. Let's look at the months of lockdown, which I think part of that was extremely confusing in its introduction and as we were coming out of it as well. But perhaps some try to reflect on some positives and negatives of being in lockdown as a family with your kids, Dr. Raki.
I think you said it absolutely right. Confusing times, not only for us as adults or parents, but also for our children. I have four children myself, and the youngest is 3 and the oldest is 9. And I think at every age, at every level, they were confused and they couldn't understand what was happening, why this was happening. Why was it happening to them? Why do I have to lock down? But mommy, why do you get to go out? You know, why is grandpa in his house? But why am I not allowed to see grandpa? You know, so it was so confusing. But let's talk about the positives, like you rightly said. I think the one positive thing I can remember is I spent a lot of time with family together. So I had, for a doctor, I had a lot of family time together. We ate our meals together. We learned new ways to keep ourselves connected with family near and far. My brother's in Singapore, so we haven't seen him in almost 2 years. So it's in a way we kept ourselves connected in various forms. And my children learned how to do house chores. You know, we learned teamwork to do it all together, you know, from the youngest to the oldest. So I think these were some of the positives I saw in my kids. Some of the negatives I see were loneliness, because my kids could not meet their friends. Even I could not see friends, cousins, relatives, family members, you know, so we were quite restricted in that sense that we could not meet people that are very close to us. There was, for children and even for us as well, there was increased online times. Everything was switched to online. So whether they were classes or extra classes, everything switched online. Kids were on their computers pretty much the whole day, and the outlets to spend energy were restricted, especially during the various MCOs.
And what about you, Melati?
So I think for me, it was a kind of a very surreal experience. So I had a baby actually in January 2020. And so I was on maternity leave, you know, during when the first MCO hit and going into that. So I just kind of felt like I had sort of a 2-year maternity leave.
But, extended maternity.
Yeah, I wasn't quite on a leave though, because I was actually, you know, taking care of the newborn and stuff like that. But, you know, the lockdown, I think, was very, very difficult because I think, like was mentioned, it was very confusing for the kids. So, you know, I had to sit them down and explain to them why they couldn't leave, why I used to go grocery shopping with my kids and I couldn't do that anymore. And I had to explain like why exactly he wasn't allowed. My husband is actually not Malaysian. So we could have to explain why we haven't seen grandparents in like years now. And for a while, I didn't let them see my own parents in Malaysia. So that was also difficult because, you know, how do you really convey this like terrible thing to, you know, a seven-year-old, to my son, my eldest is seven. So I feel like it was very, I think, stressful, but at the same time, though, I did value the time that was a bit forced on me to spend with, say, my newborn. So I definitely spent a lot of family time, which was very nice. And I felt like it sort of forced me to learn new ways to communicate information to my son. So, you know, like trying to explain the pandemic to him. And so I think those were kind of nice things that came out of it. But there were quite a few, and I should stress quite, but probably more of the negatives, like from the online learning, which I hope we'll touch on a little bit more, to sort of figuring out as a parent, you know, what do you want to let go? You know, I'm a very privileged person, but even I was struggling. So, you know, I was thinking about other families who maybe didn't have as much support as I did, you know, from my husband and my parents, like how it must be really horrible for them. And so I guess there are quite a few negatives and, you know, looking at sort of the kids waste away almost at home, having this very insular childhood where, you know, when I was seven, I was running around with friends and getting into all kinds of mischief, and having this kid have to sit in front of a TV screen all day is really, a computer screen all day was really kind of heartbreaking to me.
Yeah. So your older son is seven and your baby would be almost two by now. Am I right?
Correct.
So your little one, you know, was a lockdown baby, you know, went through those two formative years being just with the family, probably not seeing many people outside of the family. What have been some challenges as you're trying to transition out of this kind of living? And, you know, has your baby been having any issues?
Yeah, so maybe Dr. Rocky can speak a bit about this as well. But one thing I have noticed is that, I don't know whether this is true for all COVID babies, but certainly for mine, she's very hesitant around strangers. So for most of her life, she's only been around like five people. So I recently, a couple, like 2 months ago, started her back in daycare, and getting her back into, you know, being cared for by other people was incredibly difficult because she was screaming nonstop basically for like the first 2 weeks. I think the first day she refused to eat anything at school. Like kind of like a frightened animal almost, like, you know, like who are these people? And the severe mistrust, which is understandable because again, she's only been around five people. So that has been actually very, very challenging for me, just to get her back into, you know, quote, real, you know, social world. And the other thing I've also noticed is that she's just a bit more, I don't want to use the word spoiled, but I think she's used to, you know, people having basically a lot of people spending a lot of attention on her because, you know, we've all basically catered to all of what she needs, right, all the time. So if I were to compare like her versus my non-COVID baby, I would definitely say she's used to more hands-on, very like close micromanaging in terms of parenting.
Dr. Rocky, what do you think and what have been your observations with other so-called COVID babies as well?
So I think during this whole lockdown period, besides just COVID babies, we were also seeing a rise in various forms of developmental delays, especially in speech and, as Melati mentioned, social aspects. You know, we were seeing persistent stranger anxiety in the lockdown babies because, like you said, you know, your kid's been around five people their whole life, and all of a sudden you're going to introduce them to about 20, 30 people in a birthday party or in daycare center or something, you know. So we were seeing a lot of delay in these aspects, and parents were working from home. So previously when we saw developmental delays that were delayed in presentation, we were actually seeing these children a bit more earlier because parents were picking these things up earlier because they were sitting at home and noticing their child more obvious. Mm-hmm. You know, more family time spent at home. Parents were noticing, hey, my kid's already five and he can't say ABC at all. You know, I think something's up. Let's go and see a doctor. You know, so there were some good ways about it, but there were also bad ways in the sense that, you know, like there were a lot of things that were not being picked up as well. There was also an increase in mental health issues. So I think this hasn't been brought to much awareness, especially when it comes to children. When everybody talks about mental health, they always go, oh, the adult mental health, you know, a lady mental health, men mental health, but nobody talks about a child's mental health, because we have been actually seeing a rise in anxiety and depression cases and sadly suicide cases among adolescents. And this is a scary thing to note. We were also seeing more gadget addictions in children as young as 1 to 2 years old. You know, so I saw a few patients that came to my clinic that just couldn't get their hands off the phone. You know, like if I removed it, they would throw a huge fit or tantrum until the phone is back into their hands. So, you know, so we were seeing real gadget addictions in the younger group. Another group of children that were sadly missed out was children with chronic underlying chronic conditions. They were missing out on their routine follow-up. So getting admitted for complications of their diseases, which would have been preventable if they had been able to come for their regular follow-ups. If you remember correctly, at one point during some of the, I can't even remember how many MCOs we've been through, but during some parts of the MCO, they actually said only one person was allowed in the car. Mm-hmm. Or if you're bringing a child, only maximum of 3 people were allowed in the car, then it was maximum 4 people. So I have families that have 3 or 4 kids. And so parents can't leave one child behind and just bring 2 of them. Yep. So they have a lot of difficulty to come for follow-up because of the restrictions per number of in a car, you know. So that was a huge dilemma that we had to go through. And it was a very difficult period for me and my patients. And then we had the healthy children who were missing out on their routine vaccines. I just recently had a baby that was also born in January 2020. I last saw them in March 2020. And they never came back for follow-up, never saw anybody throughout the whole lockdown in the past 2 years. And they just came back last month. So this is a newborn baby that I first saw. And now he's a toddler running around unvaccinated, you know, and the mom's like, saya takut sangat. I just so scared to go anywhere. So I just kept him at home, doctor. I didn't see anybody and nobody came to visit me, you know. So a lot of delayed immunizations. This was exposing this group of healthy children to unnecessary vaccine preventable diseases. Mm. The last point I'd like to bring up, Xiaoyi, is that there was an increase in domestic abuses because there was inability of parents or children to actually reach out to get their form of self-care in forms of outdoor activities in school. And I'll talk a little bit about this later on.
Joey, can I add something to what Dr. Raki was saying? So I'd like to really echo, I guess, the 2 points of mental health and also the fear of coming in, because there were definitely, like before, as a parent, it would definitely be like, if you know, she has a kids have a cough or anything, I'd be like, oh my gosh, we need to see the doctor ASAP. But now it's like, can she still breathe? Is everything okay? If we can postpone, because, you know, you're sheltering them, right? So it's like, we cannot see the outside world and whether they get sick. So we kept up with the vaccinations. There were definitely days where it was like, should we see the doctor? I don't know. I mean, like Dr. Raki, because like everybody's worried it's COVID, right? So like whenever it's like a sore throat or whatever, I always like immediately swab the kids and stuff. Yes. But it seems like it's quite a bit to expect on the parents to, you know, keep the kids home for, what are your thoughts on that?
I don't think, so for me, for the peace of mind, I don't swab. We have now in my hospital, in my clinic, we have the lollipop test for kids. Mm. So you just put it into their mouth, they suck on it like a lollipop for a few minutes and then close it. So it's a one device, put it in, take it out, close it, wait for the results in 10 minutes. So it's really quick.
Nice.
I feel that more parents should, and you can just buy it off the pharmacy, you know, I think more parents should get these simple testing devices rather than stuffing things up their nose or getting them to spit when you, a one-year-old no way is going to be able to spit. So I think that testing should be part of the norm. I don't see why we can't. It's very difficult for us as doctors to differentiate between the common cold, COVID-19, influenza, or any other respiratory viruses. The only thing we have is a timeline and a risk of exposure. So if the parents are unvaccinated, recently got exposed in a party, then I know that, okay, COVID is high on the rank. But at this point in Klang Valley, where we still have, you know, 5,000 cases daily in Malaysia, I would still say anybody that comes with any respiratory symptoms, just do the lollipop test for your kids and make sure everything is okay. I routinely test my kids almost on a weekly, two-weekly basis so that I feel safer to send them to school. And I test myself also so I feel safer when I see patients. You know, so I just think it's part of the norm and we should find something that's less invasive and more comfortable for us.
But in terms of the mental health, like I would really like to highlight that as well. Like I mentioned, with my 7-year-old, you know, this is like a vivacious 7-year-old boy, and just watching him, like I use this word rot, because like just looking him, watching him like rot at home as sort of this prime like childhood age and being sad about it, it was really, really just really heartbreaking. And so there was a part of me, you know, I'm not a doctor, but there was a part of me that, you know, was reading stuff about kids maybe not getting that sick or not needing ICU and thinking like maybe we should take the risk. And because I mean the mental health costs were just so high with letting them not be at school.
Let's go for a quick break and pick up on that point about children's mental health when we come back. I'm speaking to Dr. Raki Yadav, consultant pediatrician, and Dr. Melati Nongsari, a parent, about how the year has been for parents and children amid school closures, you know, fears about children's health and safety, and how families are finally easing back into some normalcy. Stay tuned. Health and Living will be right back. BFM 89.9. Welcome back to Health and Living with me, T. Xiao Yik. This is the third episode of our Year That Was series, where we look back at some of the ups and downs of the year from different aspects. Today, I'm speaking to Dr. Raki Yadav, consultant pediatrician, and Dr. Melati Nongsari, a parent. Well, they're both parents, actually. And we're looking at how the year has been for parents. We've talked about, you know, the confusion and chaos of the SOPs that kept changing. We've talked about the impact of children being in isolation. And right before the break, we touched on children's mental health. And I think there is the risk of us neglecting children's experiences of mental health problems simply because they don't typically emote when they are feeling anxious or depressed the same way that adults might. They perhaps don't have the vocabulary to express those emotions yet. And it presents very much in terms of behavior. And correct me if I'm wrong, Dr. Raki, but even things like, you know, suddenly their sleeping pattern changes, they're waking up a lot more, which can be, and I understand, in a practical sense, frustrating for parents, but it's something that we need to link to their mental health. Am I right?
Absolutely. So we were seeing children with sleeping disorders, children who came in with eating disorders, you know, from someone who was eating very healthily, suddenly they're very picky, or they would overeat, you know, leading into a more sedentary lifestyle, which eventually led into overweight and obesity in some of these children. And that further spiraled downwards into their mental health, because now you're not only a sad kid, you know, yeah. So now it's just a spiral downwards in that sense for these children.
Yeah. And just want to highlight on that point about delayed vaccinations. Is it too late now for parents who may have skipped some jabs for their kids? Is it too late to come back and catch up?
Please come back. It's never too late. Always bring your book along with you and see the doctor so that they can go through the books and catch up wherever we can. So pediatricians know what vaccines are due for which times and how we can actually do a catch-up vaccination schedule for our patients with whichever vaccine that is available. Whether you're a Malaysian or whether you're an expat living in Malaysia, just bring your vaccine book along and see your pediatrician and they'll be able to sort out your catch-up schedule very, very nicely with just a few shots due away.
All right. Let's look at, we've already discussed how all the confusion and the chaos affected all of us as families. Is there anything else that you'd like to bring up in terms of, especially I think, not just the decisions or policies that were announced, but the way that they were announced and communicated to the public? How did you find yourself and your kids affected by that process? Melati?
So, I mean, there was a lot of confusion. It was funny because, you know, for a while when the MCO first, when the pandemic first started, my son would get used to, you know, us being like, okay, hush, it's 5 p.m. now. The government is going to announce, like, you know, the new restrictions and stuff like that. And I mean, he would always, like, the word government became something that he was familiar with because we would sit in front of the TV and wait. But these were very stressful. Like, there's no such thing as, like, planning long term. A lot of like co-curricular activities. So, you know, we do some art classes for him and some music. I mean, all of that was just a mess, trying to pivot online and just understanding what the rules were was just incredibly hard. Like what Dr. Rocky said, like how many people can the parents come to medical appointments for mm-hmm. children? Like, should we even all be in one car? I mean, it was a mess. And with regards to schooling, I really thought that they should have given sort of a longer runway for parents to prepare. Because again, you know, I think this year we were at least given, so the recent school opening, we were at least given a couple weeks, but during MCOs of last year, we were really only given a couple days to prepare. And, you know, getting like the whole family into a new routine and stuff like that, it takes quite a bit of effort. So sometimes I wonder whether policymakers are so far away from childbearing years that they've forgotten all of this planning that needs to go into, you know, parenting. So,
yep.
I absolutely agree, yes. Malathi. I mean, parents and children both were very confused. And I think the guidelines kept changing. And there was like no one clear-cut one-stop center that for us to look at these guidelines. You know, if you look at the Ministry of Education website, it will say ABC. If you look at the Ministry of Health website, it will say XYZ. You know, and then if you go to the roadblocks and you're stopped by the cops, they will tell you a totally different, you know, lingo. You know, so everybody was at different levels even when the guidelines were released. So I think there was confusion at every level. And I agree with you. Maybe everybody has left the childbearing ages, so that's why they don't know that. You know, there's a lot more that goes into just starting your kid back in school. You know, so I think one good thing that our Minister of Education did was, like he said, you don't need to wear uniforms. You don't need to wear your shoes and things like that, and don't have to worry about the studies. And he kept it very free and easy because it was very difficult for some parents to transition their children back into school. And the different schedules for different age groups when the school was to reopen. Like, I remember I was there at the press conference when the Minister of Education announced the whole thing. And I mean, it's a 1 hour long press conference on how schools should reopen. And it was utter confusing. You know, parents were still messaging me on the side. Teachers were still messaging me, Doc, what do we do? Should we open or close? I didn't quite get what he was saying. You know, so it was so confusing. And even now with this sort of rotation system where it's 1 week on, 1 week off, the hybrid schedule for some schools, it can really get very confusing for both parents and kids, and especially for parents with multiple kids, you know, because it's difficult. If it's one kid, fine, you just know, okay, I just need to do this. But if you've got, like me, you've got four kids and you've got to figure out, okay, who's on and who's off? Who are you off school? Who are you on school?
There have definitely been parents who have mistakenly sent their kids for the wrong...
Yeah. All the time, yes.
Just a little bit more about schooling. You know, the way I see it, I felt like learning, education became the biggest victim of lockdown. It seemed to me as if we can just sacrifice school going as an important essential activity. Just shut the schools, you know, the moment you want to think about lockdown, open them the last. From a professional perspective, Dr. Rocky, looking at what's best for children in their best interests, what could have been a better way to manage this?
So I think what they actually did was they shut schools first and they opened them last, which is what you correctly said, right? But I think what would have been best would have been allowing a hybrid option as early as possible, right? So parents who have children who are in the B40 group who need the food, their daily meals, could come into school. Those parents who are daily wagers could send their kids to school. You know, those who are, you know, living in rural areas could send their children to school. And those who felt a little bit uncomfortable or they had an immunocompromised person living in the same household could opt for the hybrid option. You know, so I think this hybrid thing should have been brought much more earlier. I mean, 2 years into the pandemic, I'm sure we could have thought of some way to figure this one out. A total lockdown, especially during the first MCO, if you remember, March 2020, that one, I think, warranted a school closure for a couple of months. But after that, I think with more and more adults getting vaccinated, SOPs were starting to get more into place and more transparent. I think the schools should have reopened much more earlier with clearer guidelines so that it could help them out with this. Let me just bring forth one recent study that was published. This was done in Korea, and it looked at the epidemiological data and roles of transmission in school. between February and December of 2020. So the incidence rate was lower among school-aged children, which was about 60 to 80 per 100,000, compared to adults, which was 130 per 100,000 people infected, right? So household was the main route of transmission, followed by community, which means in the workforce and things like that. And finally, a school cluster only came up to about 7%. Right. So, and this was done in all schools. It was a retrospective study. So it was done retrospectively, and it was done in schools in Korea. And they realized that the COVID cases was the highest, 52% in secondary schools, followed by 40% in primary schools, and just 3% in kindergarten. So with less than 10% school clusters, I think closing schools on a long-term basis was more detrimental in this case rather than bringing forth more. I mean, because we were worried that if we send our kids to school, they're going to get infected. But then now more and more, I think this was just one study that I picked up, but there were a few other studies done worldwide that looked at school clusters being very few worldwide as well. And let me just put this here, that schools do not only play a role in education, but it also serves as a food source for many children for the B40 families. It is also a way to escape the various forms of stresses at home. And in, like, this is where I mentioned the domestic abuse cases. There was another study that was done in America that showed that there was a decrease in allegations of abuse from school for domestic violence, but there was an increase in domestic violence reports, right? Which shows that many children were actually very vulnerable in an unsafe, abusive home environment during this whole pandemic time.
Dr. Melati, your thoughts as a parent?
So I completely agree. I think that, I think, like, just like Dr. Rocky said, I think at the beginning where we were not sure what was happening, I think it made sense for them not to be in school, for it to close. But I honestly believe and know for a fact that Malaysia has had one of the longest school closures in the world. We've kept kids at home for months and months. And although this, you know, will translate into real consequences later, which I feel like we did not really weigh in very much. And so my hope going forward is that the government consider all of these effects and the fact that, you know, like what Dr. Rocky said, schooling is not only for education, it's for parents to rely on, you know, reliable childcare. We've seen a lot of cases, I think as parents, I follow this quite a bit, issues where, you know, kids left at home have found themselves in very unsafe situations. I have a friend who works for a hospital here where, you know, the father went to send the elder brother and the elder sister climbed out of a window. I mean, all of this, like, horrible stuff. I truly believe that some of this could actually be alleviated with keeping schools open and keeping them open, particularly for those who really need them, like, you know, daily wage earners and the B40 and stuff like that. For privileged parents, I think it's easy to say, I want to keep my kid home. But for a lot of parents, it's not going to be the case. So I definitely agree with, you know, moving forward, keeping schools as open as possible. And then the other thing I wanted to mention going back is that there is this whole sort of like childcare ecosystem, what I call it, around sending your kid to school, which actually has kind of died a little bit due to the recession. So just to give you an example, like my daycare, where I sent my daughter last year for a bit, a small business, it actually went out of, it went bankrupt, right? Mm. So because they couldn't, people weren't paying fees, and with all these lockdowns, it just could not sustain their business. So they closed, and that it meant that I had to spend a couple weeks looking into new childcare places, which puts, you know, burden on parents basically to find alternative childcare options. Our transporter, so the person who, the uncle who used to take my son to school, also went out of business because mm-hmm. of the pandemic. So again, that's the ecosystem surrounding getting kids back to school, right? And so I feel like as a parent, it's been very stressful trying to figure out schooling because, you know, with this rotational thing and also like just like the support ecosystem is just kind of lacking right now. Especially affordable quality childcare in many ways. So, I mean, that's going to be a really big issue, I think, going forward.
Yeah. I mean, we never recognized the problem we had. We did not professionalize, you know, childcare and really welfare in our country. It was always left up to a very informal sector. And, right. You know, unfortunately, this is what we're reaping right now. Online learning. This must be a huge bugbear for the both of you. Take it away.
When Melati said that Malaysia was one of the few countries in the world that had prolonged school closure, we actually closed for almost 40 weeks in Malaysia, compared to many other countries that closed for maybe 8 to 10 weeks. So ours was 40 weeks. So can you imagine a child going online learning for 40 weeks? So initially, it was a good replacement. Kids were all excited. It meant free flow of gadget usage, screen time. I can do whatever I want. Mom, I'm just studying. Mom, I'm doing homework. You know, mom, actually, they're all playing games. You know, but towards the end of 2021, I think there was a definite rise in online fatigue, even among adults, and my kids as well. So they would log into class and they would switch off videos. They would be sleeping in their beds. They would be reading a book, or they would be even playing games on the side while the teacher is teaching. They'll be watching YouTube videos. And then I pity the teachers, because now you've got 30, 40 kids all on small, small screens all over. And then there's one teacher who's shouting, you know, are you paying attention? Can you please switch off the video? Are you there? Is your mom next to you? Who's giving you the answer? Can you switch on videos? Are your lights on? You know, like, the teachers are continuously struggling to get attention for their class kids. So I can't, it's just too long. So online classes have been going on for too long. And they do not recommend online exposure or gadget usage, screen time below 2 years old, unless it is to call a loved one for a short video chat, right? So below 2 years old, zero screen time, unless it's for a video chat. Between the ages of 3 to 5, it's only recommended for educational purposes and not more than 1 hour per day of high quality program. Above 6 years old, and this includes the teenagers, it is actually recommended not to let social media or screen time displace other important activities like their sleep, regular exercises, family meals. And I think one thing that's important for all of us is that we should not be using screens 1 to 2 hours before bedtime. Mm. As parents, I think it is important to be good role models and reduce our own online usage as well as with regards to social media. We should actually be able to guide our children to proper online content and also get involved in their online usage. So this is by setting certain limits or boundaries, like, okay, you're off, you've got maybe 1 hour of this. And then, you know, so this is where the family time screen, there's an app for it. So everybody is under that app, and then you can adjust. Okay, child A has got 2 hours of screen time for today, and they've already used 1.5 hours. The moment it hits 2, automatically the screen time goes off. Mm. You know, so you're setting your limits and boundaries within something that you can control. And I think it's very important for parents. This is what I do personally as well, is to set aside media-free times at home. So between 5 to 7 in the evening for me is a media-free time. Everybody go out of the house, everybody play. I don't care whether you're just sitting in the porch and watching the birds, but you're out of the house and you're getting some movement. Mm. You know, so I think media-free time should be something that everybody should incorporate into their daily life.
Yeah, I'd like to see a lot of adults doing that as well. Melati, what have been your experiences with online learning?
So the thing is, you know, again, like, I have so many privileges in my life. My husband and I are both educators as well, but even we struggled so much. And I think what happened for a lot of parents is that we had to make choices, right? So do you sit in your meeting or do you sit next to your kid while they do their math lesson online? And I think for a lot of people, us included, it meant that we chose basically what classes to prioritize. We could not, for all of our mental health sake, be in online classes from, like, you know, 8:30 to 1 or whatever. So we chose, right? So we only did math, BM, English. And I was like, if you can count and you can speak and read, that's fine with me. I mean, bare minimum, that's fine with me. Because honestly, like, I just could not do more than that. And, you know, this is coming from a place of privilege. And I think for a lot of parents, it's either you just sort of set the phone up or set the gadget up and kind of walk away and hope that learning happened, although it probably didn't. Right. And so I truly believe, just as a parent and professionally as an educator, that online learning, especially for young ones, you know, like primary school kids, I mean, it just does not work. And I do not want to go back to a world where I have to choose between, you know, going to a work meeting or supervising math class, because that is not not a good trade-off.
Yes. I'm very sure all parents out there were hitting that mute button and then screaming their lungs out at the side. Speaking personally, I made the decision to send my son back to kindergarten, you know, when it reopened a few months ago, because handling and facilitating the online classes was so difficult. What are the concerns or challenges that parents are facing now with schools reopening? It's not an easy decision to make to send kids back as well. Dr. Raki, what are your observations of parents you've been talking to?
So I think the priority for me to send back my child to certain schools was to know that the teachers and staff in that school, this is my number one priority, that they were fully vaccinated. The teachers and the staff, and even the kakaks who are helping to cook and help to clean or whatever, were fully vaccinated. Then I would actually ask the principals about their COVID-19 SOPs or protocols that they had in place. And some of the schools would actually reach out to request help with their SOPs. And I felt safer recommending these schools to friends, as I knew that they were following SOP. They had a proper plan of action in case there was an exposed teacher or a child. Mm. Another factor I think that came into play was parental work schedule. So many parents were initially working from home for the longest period. And I think a lot of people were very happy with that. But they could keep their children at home with them. However, when more and more sectors began to open up, there was like inadequate places where these children could go to, you know, until October this year, when Ministry of Education announced that, okay, we're finally reopening the schools in stages. So in 2020, if some of y'all will remember, there was also a discrimination among frontliners' children in certain schools, as they were thought to be, you know, high risk in view that their parents were working in a high risk environment. I think this was rather unfair to many frontliners who were struggling to maintain their family and work life during a stressful period. And some of the challenges that we had included getting into a routine of things. Of the so-called new norm, everybody keeps saying new norm, but there was no proper routine that we could get into. Schooling has changed, introduction of this rotation system, wearing of masks, you know, reduction of co-curricular activities, reduced mingling. You know, you can't even meet your friends during recess time. Now it's everybody sit on your own desk and eat in your classrooms. Parents as well as children were getting fearful of getting infected when they restart school. So especially with children below 12 years old, so this would be the primary school parents like Melati and myself. And there was a lot of loss of trust in various decision makers when cases were not really handled very well as it should have been. So whether these decision makers were policy makers or even school management, you know, administrators and all that, it was something that came into picture as part of the challenges that we face.
Yeah. Dr. Melati, how did it feel to send your baby to daycare, you know, your son back to school?
So I did the same thing I think Dr. Raki did, which I verified vaccination status. I also asked for what was their, you know, general sort of guidelines for the SOP. I also talked to them about ventilation, right? Because we know now that, you know, ventilation is sort of one of our defenses against this virus. And so, I mean, some of these conversations were actually kind of uncomfortable for me as a parent to be, because it's very like it feels invasive to be like, I need to know what your protocols are and, you know, before I can trust you, right? But I think one thing that has been, that parents have had to do is to trust in these institutions to keep our kids safe and to verify perhaps to the best of our abilities. But after that, you know, I don't know what happens between the time 9 to 1. I hope everything good is happening, but, you know, to sort of the trust in these institutions and sort of having, you know, open dialogues about this. So I think that that has been sort of key for me. One thing though, with regards to, you know, just talking to friends and stuff like that, I truly do believe that, you know, every family has their own risks to go through. So for example, like if you're living with somebody immunocompromised, if your kid has, you know, existing medical issues, I mean, if you personally just don't feel comfortable, I think that choice should be accommodated. For a lot of these parents, but I do still believe that the default is that school should remain open. And then if you can choose to remove your child, but I don't think the default should be online learning.
A quick word, Dr. Raki, on vaccinations. Parents' concerns about getting their teens vaccinated, although we have a pretty high rate of completed vaccinations for teens, but, you know, the younger kids will probably start coming in for that next year. Any advice for us parents?
So when vaccines were rolled out, I think most of us adults, like, I couldn't wait to get myself vaccinated because I felt this was some way out of this whole mess. So when the time came to vaccinate our teenagers, I think the main concern most parents had was safety of the vaccine. And we have to understand that the technology of vaccines is such that it leaves our body within 72 hours. So the risk of any long-term effects is almost nil and historically has never been recorded ever in any vaccine, right? So the rare side effect of myocarditis suddenly took center stage and created a lot of fear among parents as well as some teenagers themselves who used to read a lot of things, you know? So majority of myocarditis cases occur in males after the second dose of the mRNA vaccine, and usually between day 2 to 7. Studies now show that the post-vaccine myocarditis is not the same as the myocarditis we get post-infection. It is relatively very mild with no long-term effects and majority resolve without any treatment. But we need to remember that the global risk of myocarditis post-vaccination is about 12 per million, but it's 37 times higher in children infected with COVID-19. For every 1 million doses of the mRNA vaccine given, it prevents 40 to 50 myocarditis cases. So the effect of myocarditis post-COVID-19 infection is more damaging and more long-lasting compared to the myocarditis post-vaccine. So this needs to be said out there. And Pfizer has recently released very encouraging data and has started vaccinating. I think we've vaccinated almost 5 million children in USA since November, and these are children between the ages of 5 to 11 years old. The efficacy of this vaccine is 91% against infection and is only 1/3 the dose of adult Pfizer vaccines. You know, hence the side effect profile is a lot milder. Until date, very good news is that there's been no myocarditis or pericarditis cases reported. Mm. So with more than 5 million doses given, no reported cases of myocarditis or pericarditis. And I'd also like to bring forth here one point that the buffer used is also different compared to the adult Pfizer vaccine, which makes it more temperature stable. So if you remember when the vaccine first came out, Pfizer had to be kept in like minus 80 degrees or things like that. So it was very difficult to move the vaccine around. So with this change of buffer, the temperature is more stable. So we can also reach out to children even in rural areas around the world. Unfortunately, Malaysia has not brought this vaccine yet due to vaccine equity issues worldwide, but I'm still eagerly awaiting to give it to my children as soon as the vaccine is available. So I have no doubts that this vaccine is one way out for our kids. And my children can't wait as well. They're like, are we getting the COVID vaccine today, Mom? Are we getting it? You're getting it. You just got the booster. When is my turn? Mm. You know, so I just want to reassure parents that getting your children vaccinated is one of the best things that you can do for them to safeguard their health in the coming future. Because a lot of people have been messaging me and saying that, oh, you're putting your kids as a guinea pig by getting them vaccinated. But I feel it's the other way around. All of us are vaccinated. More than 90% of adults and adolescents have been vaccinated in our country. So the only guinea pigs left are the children who are unvaccinated, the newborns who are unable to get vaccinated, because these are the guinea pigs that are exposed to such a deadly disease. So I think we should be less and less worried about the vaccine and more worried about what the disease can cause, because we know that the research has gone into this disease and technology to make vaccine safe for children is much more stringent with a lot of restrictions and guidelines for it to be rolled out in a child. And for something that's not so often in children, COVID-19 is not as often as in adults. We definitely need more research before we actually can roll out the vaccine. So the fact that we have all of that already in our background, I wouldn't think twice to vaccinate our children.
Yeah. We've been talking so much and as parents, this is what we do. We talk about our kids first. We talk about their challenges. We talk about how we want to make things better for them. But really, how has this year been for you? And I'll go first, you know. It's been horrible. And as a parent, I feel like I've just lost that sense of personhood. You know, I don't know who I am anymore. I am just somebody who's struggling to keep all the balls in the air. No more boundaries at home. So that's me. So, I mean, the idea of this was to look at the year that was for parents. So how has it been for you personally?
Maybe I can go. So I agree. It's been terrible. It's been, I was describing this to somebody the other day. It's almost like you've basically lost pieces of yourself that you're not sure you're ever going to regain, right? So I think we just live inherently in a riskier world. And with kids, you will always worry more about them now with COVID. But And I feel like parents should sort of give themselves a bit more grace and maybe space to, you know, kind of take time off for yourself if you need it. I remember the first day I was able to send my daughter to daycare and my son to school, I was like, I'm going to get so much stuff done. Like, I'm going to work. But then when I sent them, I just sat there at the dining table, like being like, I can breathe now for a little bit, you know? So I think, I think that's fine. I think being self-indulgent and sort of caring about your own time after 2 years of basically just looking out for other people is completely justified and something that I think we should all do more.
Dr. Rocky?
Sorry, I loved what Malati said because I could relate to it so much. I felt like I lost 2 years of my life. You know, because literally work-wise, it's been completely horrendous because we don't see much cases. People, like I said, people were not coming to clinics, you know, so work-wise, there was a huge reduction. So I didn't have to come to work more than twice a week, you know, so I was at home practically the whole time. And when you're at home, you're constantly a mom rather than a doctor, and you're constantly a daughter, a mother, a sister, you know, you're everybody else but yourself. And when you're working, you can actually be like, I'm Dr. Rocky at work. You know, I'm me. But when I go back home, I'm everybody else's somebody. You know, so you lose a little bit of yourself. And I felt like I've lost a lot of myself in this past 2 years. And I think parents, mothers or fathers should be given a little bit of time out so they can go and self-care a little bit. Like, I believe in self-indulgence. So whether it's just you going to the mama shop and having a cup of tea, or whether it's you taking a staycation, you know, taking a breather from everything, we all deserve it, because I think our cups are completely empty and we need to refill our little love buckets. So we need to empty all the rest of the unnecessary stuff, the baggage that we're carrying for the past 2 years. And hopefully 2022 will bring us more clear-cut guidelines, will bring us more exposure, will let us travel in safety, you know. And I hope that the next few years will also bring about more awareness for the disease and mental health for parents as well as children.
Mm. Just the last word from each of you. You know, you mentioned that policies were made and communicated so poorly, and partly because policymakers were, you know, so far from the realities of, you know, the communities, right? So what would you like to see done better in 2022, Dr. Malati?
I would like to see more consultation with parents, honestly. My biggest issue with a lot of policies made, so for example, Ministry of Education, I feel does not see parents as partners. Rather, they feel like they need to sort of from the top of their mountains, like throw things at us and we're supposed to catch them. I would really like to see more consultative processes with parents, because I haven't seen that happen. And I feel like that needs to happen more, especially going forward. And I guess the last thing I would like to say would also be, you know, I think we all need to prep for a marathon. It's not a sprint. It's not a 100 meters run. It's going to be this, like, I don't know, 200 kilometer thing. And so we need to learn how to work better, policymakers and, you know, civil society in general.
Yeah. Dr. Rocky.
So from a professional standpoint, I feel that we should have a one-stop center. So I'm hoping that the COVIDnow.com website will be able to do this, where you have a one-stop center guideline where everything we can refer there in case we're unsure, rather than different ministries coming up with separate decisions and nobody knows head or tail of what's happening. And these guidelines should be known at every level. So from the policymaker right at the top to the bottom line frontliners, you know, so, you know, everybody at every level should know that these are the guidelines and these are the ones that we should follow. So a one-stop center to refer to. That's the first thing. The second thing is, I think we should have a few more parenting workshops to guide parents and children to a safer reopening. Not to say safer in the sense that they would feel scared or things like that, but just to guide them and tell so that they know that we are here. This is the way that we can do it. If you need, this is the safety net that you have. These are the numbers that you can call if you feel this way. For children, these are the teachers that you can actually approach for various things, you know. So I think we should have some sort of awareness campaigns or maybe mental health campaigns, parenting workshops for people, whether it's done at, so I just did a parenting workshop for a corporate company, you know. So I think it was very useful. You know, almost 400 employees attended and they found it so useful because they got all the information that they needed from just one hour of discussion. So like what Malati was saying, we need to engage with, you know, ministries need to engage with the parents so that you get a clear-cut guideline from both sides and a happy conclusion from both parties.
All right. Thank you so much. I've been speaking to, well, two parents, Dr. Melati Nongsari and Dr. Raki Yadav. And Dr. Raki is also a consultant pediatrician. We've been discussing the year that was for parents and children. You've been listening to Health and Living on BFM 89.9.
Thank you for listening to this podcast. To find more great interviews, go to bfm.my or find us on iTunes. BFM 89.9, the business station.